This lecture was given at the Bateman Auditorium in Gonville and Caius College, Cambridge, on Saturday the 11th of July, 2009. It was organised by Genesis Agendum. If you'd like to know more about our aims and our work, please see our website, www.genesisagendum.org.uk.
Professor Fuller is Professor of Sociology at the University of Warwick. He's the author of many papers and some 15 books, including The Intellectual, The Positive Power of Negative Thinking, and Science versus Religion, Intelligent Design and the Problem of Evolution. He also has a new book coming out in the autumn entitled The Sociology of Intellectual Life, The Career of the Mind in and Around the Academy. In 2008, Icon published his book Descent Over Dissent, Intelligent Design's Challenge to Darwinism, and that's the title to which you'll be speaking to us this evening. So, Professor Fuller, it's a very good pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much. First, let me start by thanking the organizers of this event. I do think that the issues that are involved here are incredibly important for everyone concerned. And as was already indicated in the introduction, I'm very much concerned about the role of intellectual life in society. And if any issue exemplifies that, right, it is the issue having to do with creationism, intelligent design, and evolution, because this is an issue that goes very much to the heart of very fundamental views that are taught not only at universities to specialists, but to ordinary people at the school level that they should be carrying along as citizens, informed citizens of a society. So there's a sense in which we're talking about what ultimately matters, the ultimate sense of canon, you might say, in terms of knowledge in society. Because sometimes people ask me whether this kind of work that I'm doing now in terms of discussing, maybe even promoting intelligent design theory is continuous with stuff that I've done before. I'm primarily known as, my original training was in history and philosophy of science. I have a PhD from the University of Pittsburgh, which is often regarded as the best department in the country in that area. And I did an MPhil here at Cambridge. I was a fellow of Clare College. And I worked with Mary Hesse and Gert Buchdahl. And one of the things that was very constant during my training, though admittedly it wasn't something that I sort of dedicated many of my publications to early on, was this idea that we would not have had modern science in the form that we have it now, and especially with this kind of this sort of drive toward progress and it being kind of emblematic of how human beings distinguish themselves from other animals, were it not for a certain kind of theological perspective that came to the fore in the 17th century and what is associated with the scientific revolution. Now, the scientific revolution is often talked about as the period where one gets the ascendancy of the mechanical worldview. Okay, and I think it's very important to understand what exactly that means, because that's a very relevant expression for this debate that we're talking about now in terms of intelligent design and evolution. Okay, because I think there's a tendency, given sort of the downstream consequences of how this image has been applied over the last 400 years, to have a very kind of negative view about what mechanism means and what it means to have a sort of mechanistic worldview. But in fact, the original idea, right, that was very instrumental here was the idea that it was artifice, okay? The idea that one can understand nature as an artifice, okay? And the idea of artifice here is that this is our ability to create machines, to create technologies that manage not only to enhance our condition, but in a way to extend it and to make us increasingly more different from the other animals, is a signature aspect of our divine privilege. In fact, this was the thing that came to be interpreted, especially in the 17th century, as evidence of our having been created in the image and likeness of God. Because God is the divine artificer, and we do something of the same sort with regard to technology, engineering, the reorganization of the environment, and stuff of that kind. Now, there tends to be a negative spin put on this kind of picture, I have to say, among contemporary historians and philosophers of science very often, okay? Because especially if you think about people who are very much committed to the environmental movement and stuff of that kind. But I think it's very clear that if you look at the attempts to sort of try to make cognitive sense of what it means to be created in the image and likeness of God, take that very seriously, this sort of Genesis idea, that you start to think, well, what, you know, if we are different from all the other animals, what is it that differentiates us? And it's this business of the artifice, of the machine making, okay? And I think that this kind of idea starts to become very powerful, especially in the 17th century, because of the Protestant Reformation, primarily. And what the Protestant Reformation does, not only in the world that became Protestant, but generally across all of Christendom, was to get people to read the Bible. Okay? I mean, and I think that's a very important point, because if you think about the status of the Bible within Christianity prior to the 17th century, right, it's just, as it were, one of many authorities, and it is an authority that typically would be mediated by priests. Right, and it is, in fact, through the Catholic Church and the Catholic tradition, and I have to say, I'm someone who was, until I went to university, I was trained by the Jesuits, okay, so actually I'm very much steeped in that whole Catholic tradition. There's always been this kind of view of thinking of the Bible in purely metaphorical, symbolic, analogical terms, in other words, kind of giving a sort of soft focus approach to the content. Right, that in some sense can always be, as it were, put aside for something else that turns out to be the doctrine that you should be living by at the moment. Okay? And in a sense, the great triumph of Protestantism, and this is the thing, you know, the theologian Alistair McGrath talks about Christianity's dangerous idea. You know, kind of a parody of Daniel Dennett's recent book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, right? Natural selection as the kind of universal solvent for everything, right? Alistair McGrath wrote this book a few years ago called Christianity's Dangerous Idea, and this is the idea of reading the Bible, right, and taking it seriously, okay? And the thing that, you know, in a way is relevant about that kind of general message, which of course is very much part of what Protestantism is about and is why people have to kind of take personal decisions with regard to their belief in God, and it's not enough just to trust the Pope or trust the Church or trust the priest or anything like that, is this the main content issue was this business of reading in the beginning, we're creating the image and likeness of God. And it's not just the priests who are created that way, right? But all human beings, anyone who can read the message and make sense of it for themselves, they are created, right? And this, in fact, drives a lot of the proselytism, a lot of the evangelism, and so forth as well, okay? And the people who were involved in the scientific revolution basically took that idea very seriously themselves, okay? Now, the person who's recently been appointed to the chair of science and religion at Oxford, the Adreos chair, which previously had been held by John Hedley Brooke, the historian of science, right, this guy, Peter Harrison, Australian guy, he's got a couple of books that have come out over the last 10 years. You can look them up, Cambridge University Press, the press of this university, which are exactly on this point that I'm talking about now. Right, the extent to which going back to the Bible was, in fact, a very important part for many of the people who were involved in the scientific revolution, including even, as it were, you know, Catholic people like Galileo. Because one of the interesting things about Galileo, and this is why Galileo became a kind of, you know, a sort of iconic figure for a lot of Protestants, because, you know, Galileo was put under house arrest as a result of the Inquisition. You know, the sort of people who came to visit him, you know, like people like John Milton, Thomas Hobbes, okay, these are people kind of on the radical fringe, right? Kind of the Protestant type, you know, extreme people. They were the ones who found Galileo a very interesting person to talk to, okay? Because Galileo was making arguments about, well, you know, you read the Bible, you make sense of it for yourself, you don't necessarily buy all this kind of hocus-pocus that the priests are trying to obscure you with, and then you make your own judgments about stuff. Okay? And that's a very important aspect of what the scientific revolution was about, right? Deciding things for yourself, whether you're talking about the Bible or whether you're talking about nature itself. And somebody like Galileo tried to fuse the things together, and that's one reason why he turned out to be such a kind of controversial figure. But generally speaking, if you look at Robert Boyle, you look at Newton, right, you look at other people like Descartes, I mean, you look at everybody who's considered to be important during this period, right, one of the things that they do is they come up with their own interpretations of the Bible. They feel that in some sense they have to make sense of it for themselves. And they're getting very much in controversy with established clerical authorities. Okay, but it's not because they're rejecting the Bible, right? It's because they're having it speak to them directly. Okay, and what Harrison argues, and I think this is something that is certainly true in the case of Newton, that it's the business of the, you know, the Newton, it was quite clearly thought the Bible was speaking to him directly. Okay, if you look at the vast proportion of the stuff that he wrote in his lifetime, very little of which he actually published, it was mostly theological interpretation. Okay, why? Why does he do this? I mean, there was a time when people used to sort of write this off as Newton being a bit wacky. The problem is when everybody's kind of doing this, what are you going to say, the whole century was wacky? No, you can't say that, right? I mean, what you can say, of course, is that there are all kinds of institutional prohibitions against going public on these matters. And I think this has some resonance with what's going on today. Okay? So, for example, when, you know, people, you know, when people present to me the fact that, you know, 85% of scientists are atheists, blah, 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 you know, you get all these kinds of, I wonder, right? There is a lot of kind of institutional pressure against declaring any kind of connection between religion and science. And I think that, and this is kind of what the 17th century was about. And so if you look at something like the establishment of the Royal Society, okay, right, in the charter of the Royal Society, you get this very explicit prohibition of matters of rhetoric, morals, politics, religion. Right, because these are divisive matters. These are matters that the people who were involved in the society did not think they could actually manage themselves. And if they didn't manage them, they could quite easily lead to all kinds of political, social turmoil, which would be destabilizing for the country. And, of course, the Royal Society wanted a royal charter, right? So they wanted to, as it were, be able to advance science, but they didn't want to give the impression to the state that they were going to be subverting it in the process, because they would open up all of these old wounds that had just recently been healed after the Civil War in this country. Okay? And so this stuff just basically all went underground, right? So the theological backdrop that actually motivated a lot of this modern, early modern science just went underground, and then, of course, historians have recovered it and so forth. And because these figures like Boyle and Newton and so forth, in their own texts, made very sharp distinctions between science and religion, right, we, in a sense, have intellectualized and rationalized and conceptualized this distinction as real. You know, so we say, well, you know, there's this realm of science and this realm of religion, and you write about them in these different places, and they're different things. Okay? It seems to me that that kind of mentality, which I think is very much taken for granted today, and of course, in the various court, you know, in the major court case in which I was involved in the United States, I mean, some of you may know, I was an expert witness in defense of the intelligent design position, the big case that came up in Pennsylvania 4 years ago. Right, in the judge's verdict, right, there is just this taken for granted idea that science and religion are mutually exclusive. And that if you can show that something has religious motivation, ipso facto, it's out the door as far as science is concerned. Okay? Now, where does that come from exactly? It's not obvious where that comes from, okay? It's not the most obvious interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, for example, where the U.S. Constitution is basically against an established church, right? So the U.S. Constitution is primarily addressing itself to the situation in this country, right, where there's a Church of England, and you know, you think about the original pilgrims and the people who came over in the 17th century to the United States, right, these were people who were very well educated, very well-to-do people, right, but they were nonconformists with regard to the Church of England. That was typically the case. And so they basically came over to America and they established all these different colonies that eventually became the United States. And one of the things, you know, you might say is part of the collective memory of those people was that they never wanted their nation to be in a situation where if you didn't hold the right fundamental beliefs, right, you wouldn't be able to get advancement in politics, you know, in universities, and so forth. Okay, that was the idea. It was against an established church, but it was not against religion being allowed to be expressed freely within civil society. And I think one of the ways you see this is the way in which the U.S. Constitution talks about education, right? Because there is no national ministry of education in the United States. Okay, there's nothing of that sort. Education is something that is devolved to the state and local levels. Now, why is that? Well, basically because the people in charge of education ought to be the people who are paying for it, and as it were, their say ought to matter. And the idea was, what the Founding Fathers imagined was, that there would actually be quite a wide, diverse range of educational authorities, right, that would probably be influenced by a wide range of different religions, depending on the kind of people who lived in different places, and that would be okay. Right? That would be okay. Now, what happened, and even today in the United States, what you do have are sort of state-level performance standards, you know, so that if people are studying certain subjects, they have to perform a certain way. But there is still this tendency not to meddle in what's going on in the classroom with regard to exactly how the stuff is being taught. Okay? And so that's why you always have to have court cases being brought up to sort of highlight something that somebody finds offensive. Okay? And I think this is a very, you know, so there's this weird kind of general worldview thing that somehow happened in the 20th century, I think, that sort of imagines that somehow religion is inherently the enemy of science. And that if you detect it anywhere, right, you've got to get rid of it or stamp it out or put it in some other class, you know. And the thing that's amazing, if you actually read the final judgment in that case in Pennsylvania, was there was basically this idea that well, you know, science and religion, you know, religion needs to be taught in public schools too, right? But they need to be taught in their own classes. And so you start to, the rhetoric starts to, if you're an American, it starts to sound like the separate but equal doctrine with regard to racism in the United States, right? That you don't really want integration between the blacks and the whites, right? So you imagine a situation where legally you freed the slaves. So in a sense, the slaves are officially equal to the whites, okay? But then the question is, how do you enact equality? All right? And of course, there was this whole situation from the 1860s until the 1960s, the Civil Rights Act, right, in the United States, where there was separate but equal, right? Where it was possible for states to mandate that as long as there were, you know, facilities that would be deemed equal, right, you could have blacks and whites go in different places, different water fountains even, you know, different buses, whatever, okay? And it seems to me that this is kind of the attitude that these courts are taking with regard to science and religion. Of course religion needs to be taught, but not in science. Okay, regardless of the impact that religion has had in science, right? There's some presupposition that religion is somehow bad for science, right? We don't say that about other things, right, that often get brought into science classes. But we say this specifically about religion, right? And that's the problem, right? If we were like hyper-scrupulous and say, well, you know, in a science class, all you should know are data points and equations. Cool, okay, let's go for that. But that's not what they're saying. Religion is being specifically targeted here. Right, we don't have a Supreme Court case that says, separate science from politics. We have religion separated from science. Now that's interesting, okay? That's interesting and it's a little weird. Especially given, you know, that in fact religion has had a very powerful impact on the development of science. Okay, and often the people who were so motivated to do that, you know, were people who were reading the Bible, trying to make sense of it. I mean, it wasn't these people were Buddhists, they weren't Hindus, right? They were people who are, in some sense, the predecessors of the people whose views are being excluded today. That's weird. Okay, that's very weird. Okay, now I make the point this way because sometimes people think that I'm making some kind of relativist argument here, like, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom, you know, have like Hindu science in the classroom and, you know, whatever, you know. I'm not saying that at all. I actually think there's a specific positive benefit to having, Right. The Abrahamic faiths represented in some way in science. Okay? I wouldn't force feed it, but I just, it seems to me it has had a positive impact, and there should be no reason why it should be ruled out. Okay? And I do think, you know, as you see, you know, when these discussions do happen in the public forum, there is this tendency to mix up all kinds of issues, right? So you talk about all the horrible things that have happened because of religion, right? The Christopher Hitchens thing, you know. Oh, my God, but then, of course, you know, you didn't have an atomic bomb without science. And Hitler wouldn't have been able to do his worst without science, right? I mean, the point is, any form of knowledge or worldview that has access to, you know, technology, political power, economic resources, they can do all kinds of things. Okay? That goes without saying. You know, in that respect, everybody's got dirty hands. Right? You can't rule out religion uniquely on that basis, but nevertheless, there is this hang-up about religion. Okay? And I think this is a real, this is a problem that I think, you know, regardless of where you stand on this issue, this should bother you, right? Because, I mean, I have talked about in my own writings about what I see as kind of institutional bigotry against especially Abrahamic faiths, okay? And I think that's real, okay? I think that's real. And I know the people who often promote this think they're enlightened, but it's complete bigotry, okay? Now, how long have we been going on for? Because I don't want to... Who's keeping time here? Okay. No, because I do want to open this up to questions, because I'm sure people will have a lot of things to say about this. It seems to me that we're in a very kind of peculiar situation here, where a lot of issues have gotten kind of mixed up, and at the end of the day, if we're talking about science, especially in the period that we live in now, one of the things that we need to do is motivate students to want to go into science. Okay? And people, you know, when people talk about this kind of issue, and this came up very much in the trial, when we're talking about science education, right, we're not merely talking about spoon-feeding students with the latest results from all the cutting-edge disciplines. That isn't really the point. Okay? The point is to get people to think of, you know, to get them, give them a sense of what it is to think scientifically and to understand that in a way that might be somewhat different from their taken for granted notions of how to think about the world, and to realize and to get a sense of why this way of thinking about the world is important. Okay? To say that science is technical or specialist or something, of course it's that, but that doesn't quite capture why it's so important. Why do people base so many decisions on the back of it? Okay? What is it about this knowledge? You know, why do we have this kind of knowledge, right? And if you look at the history of science, one of the things that's very clear is that there has been this drive that starts with the scientific revolution that human beings can get some kind of comprehensive understanding of reality that's rational. It's not something that you can do in your lifetime. That's another important point here, right? Because we've got lots of cases throughout in the history, you know, if you do a kind of history of knowledge across cultures and so forth, where you've got, you know, the Chinese and the Indians and the Greeks and the Romans, whatever, you've got very strong moments where people develop forms of knowledge and so forth. But what you don't have is staying power. Okay? And staying power is kind of what we're talking about here. And I think it's very important now where you see the sort of decline and people going into physics and chemistry and into the fundamental kind of sciences, and that the kinds of sciences that are actually attracting people these days are the money makers. Okay? So in other words, science as a kind of project, you know, whereby human beings can get a kind of comprehensive knowledge of reality, that motivation is dissipating and is being replaced by a rather kind of a fragmented kind of drive where certain areas of science are really flourishing, okay, you know, so in biomedical sciences, for example, but without any serious kind of theoretical coverage, okay, so in a sense, they could quite easily just be incorporated, you know, you could easily take certain kinds of biomedical science departments these days and just make them into R&D divisions of corporations, and there wouldn't be anything lost, Okay, because they're not really, what's motivating them isn't really this drive towards some sort of ultimate understanding of reality, but rather, you know, being able to provide certain kinds of products for the clients who are paying for the research that's going on. Now, to be sure, there's always been that kind of issue going on in science, but the people who've been involved in it have also had this higher goal, and it's been one of the things that in the past has caused them to have problems with their with the people paying for them, right? These kinds of conflicts of, you know, you might say, in sociology we talk about the idea of role ambivalence, right? The idea that, you know, people are paying you to do certain things, but you've been trained in a way to make you think that maybe you shouldn't be doing this. Okay? Now the question is, where do you get that normative sensibility from? If the primary way in which you justify the pursuit of science is in terms of the customer always being right. Okay, where does the internal drive for science come from? Okay, now you might say, well, we're driving toward getting to the truth, getting to reality or whatever, but and that's good, that's fine, I have nothing against that, but one has to realize what's implied in that idea. Okay, because for example, if you were to go to, you know, China in its high period in the ancient world, you get, you know, great developments in various forms of technology, architectural achievements, astronomical achievements, all kinds of things going on there. What you don't get, though, is a drive toward overarching theoretical unity. Because basically, at the end of the day, Chinese believe that, sure, there was a creator and that there was some kind of cosmic force that put it all together, but we don't have any privileged relationship to that form, okay? We, you know, there's no sense of being created in the image and likeness. See, this is where we go back to the idea of the scientific revolution having to do with the mechanical worldview, where you imagine God as being the big engineer, right? Because God, then, you know, is something that in some sense we could aspire to, right? Traditionally, our notions of scientific progress were predicated on the idea that God's got a design and we're trying to figure it out, and as it were, we can measure how closer we're getting to it, because in a sense, God differs from us not in kind, but by degree. Right? The way God works is kind of how we work, but he does it much, much better. And that's why it would make sense to actually come up with things like mathematical laws of nature and stuff like that, and to think, you know, you improve these things over time, because God is a big mathematician. I mean, if you didn't think that, why do this project? And of course, the Chinese didn't think that. Now, the Indians, who had very sophisticated mathematics, right, did it pretty much as a thing in itself. And of course, you can kind of spin that out, right? All of these kinds of activities that we normally call academic disciplines, right, have enough of a self-contained character, methodologically, technically, and, you know, and otherwise, that they can be continued as a game, you might say, as a very elaborate kind of game among people who are specifically trained in these matters. But then what in philosophy we would call the ontological question, you know, does this grasp onto reality? Right, so you can be an expert chess player, but big deal. Right, you're clever, you're smart, you're technically competent, but does it hook on to anything more substantial than the chessboard? Right, and you see, now how do you, you know, where do you get that sense that, yes, what I am doing in this very localized setting, for example, a laboratory experiment, pretty localized thing, pretty artificial thing, nobody denies that. Nevertheless, we think it's generalizable, right? There's a possibility of external validity. We have ways of extending it, and when we extend it, it succeeds, right? So in a sense, we can go beyond the lab to something else, and it works. And we're confident that if we continue to do that, it'll continue to work. You see, that's not a natural attitude. That's not a that's not common sense, okay? I mean, common sense, I think, is much closer to the attitude, you know, if you're good at chess, you're good at chess. You know, so in other words, if you were good at doing a lab experiment and you're really technically proficient, that's nice, but why should we think this represents the cosmos? Okay? And obviously, well, the historic answer is because we sort of have we think that we have a special relationship with, in fact, the being behind the cosmos. You know, that being is kind of like us. Much, much better than us, but sufficiently like us that we can aspire to make sense of this.
This is really, really important. This is a really important thing. I think we're, you know, and I just don't see how you can parse this other than a theological idea. This is really the image and likeness of God stuff. I mean, and of course, let me put a little health warning on this. It doesn't follow that if you hold this view, you will be, some kind of normally understood Orthodox Christian necessarily, right? And a lot of these guys got into a lot of trouble with the various established forms of Christianity, no doubt about it. Okay, I'm kind of thinking about, and again, I don't know how familiar people are, in the 18th century, when we talk about the rise of deism, we talk about the rise of Unitarianism. Okay? Where people basically make a kind of very principled sense of saying the churches are bad because they, in fact, betray the biblical heritage. You know, in a sense, even Protestant churches have this kind of Catholic residue that needs to be purged. Okay? Because, in a sense, right, it is the individual Christian believer who's empowered. And I think if to be perfectly honest, I think that was the mentality of the American Founding Fathers. Okay, so in other words, when they put, as you know, in the United States, we have in our coins in the back, "In God we trust." I think you should take that very seriously. Right, but just because "In God we trust" doesn't mean we trust any established religions. But "In God we trust." "In God we trust," because we are creating the image and likeness of God. Okay? And I think one of the interesting kind of bellwether figures here in terms of a person who was clearly a theological person, but also a scientist who was very influential in the thinking of the Founding Fathers, especially Franklin and Jefferson, is Joseph Priestley. Okay, he's one of my icons, I have to say. I mean, again, I don't want to get into a controversial political discussion here, but we might want to talk about a left creationism. If we think about creationism as primarily a movement of conservative right, there is a kind of left creationism, a kind of empowerment version of creationism, okay, that comes out of deism and Unitarianism, and somebody like Joseph Priestley would be the exemplar of that, okay? Joseph Priestley, I don't know, how many of you are familiar with the name Joseph Priestley? Does the name mean anything to anyone here? Okay, he's often seen, and with some degree of justification, as the person who discovered oxygen. Now, he's a chemist, but he's also was a Unitarian preacher and a big, very heavy critic of institutionalized Christianity as having corrupted the biblical message. And there was quite a fashion for that kind of thing in the 18th century and the Enlightenment, and of course that became a lot of the critical historical scholarship of especially in Germany in the 19th century. Priestley was quite clearly, a believer in God and believed that God empowered him to understand the forces of nature. And one of the things that it made him very inclined to do was to actually believe, and this actually now ties back to the trial in Pennsylvania. Priestley wrote the first history of electricity and magnetism. Okay? Now, you think about electricity and magnetism as kind of forces of nature. They're very subtle. They're very counterintuitive. They're not the kind of thing, as it were, that you can really make a lot of sense of. If you just sort of say, well, billiard ball causation, if that's kind of your normal way of understanding how the world works, right? You have to somehow imagine, in some sense, action at a distance, right? Which are, in fact, the properties that were traditionally attributed to divine agency. Right, God, there's a sense in which the cause comes from out there somewhere. It doesn't come from where the action's actually happening. And Priestley kind of does the history of it. He does the first history of this, and he's the one who invents this, I don't know, myth, legend, I don't know if it's been decided yet, Benjamin Franklin with the kite and the key, discovering electricity. This first gets written up in Priestley's history, okay? Now, the thing that's very interesting about this, of course, is this is a very clear example of where someone who's quite clearly, as someone like William Blake would say, God intoxicated, right, thinking, okay, I'm creating an image and likeness of God, and this enables me to kind of understand very fundamental forces of how God operates, leading him to think about things in a way that goes beyond the kind of level of causation that, let's say, somebody like David Hume thought we normally thought out. And you see, David Hume is a very interesting foil here, right? Because he's a contemporary, basically. And David Hume basically thinks human beings are basically elaborate animals, prone to self-deception, which is, in a way, a kind of predecessor of the contemporary kind of Darwinian notion. And that's why Hume is kind of an early icon for that sort of view that's very popular now. But the interesting thing about Hume here, right, is that, you know, Hume didn't believe in any of this stuff that Priestley was talking about. And in fact, Hume believed that Newton had oversold science. And this is one of the interesting things when people start talking about Hume as a, you know, they bring in Hume to say, well, you know, Hume gave this kind of knockdown of the argument from design and theology, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but what people don't realize is that Hume wasn't just trying to knock down, you know, people who were arguing for a design from a theological standpoint, but he was also knocking down the kind of larger metaphysical pretensions of somebody like Newton and his followers, who thought that somehow one could get into the mind of God, which is what Newton thought the whole idea of coming up with the fundamental forces of nature was about. Okay, now Priestley took Newton very seriously, and so as a result, he said, you know, electricity, magnetism, as we move into these areas where, as it were, the forms of causation escape what normally passes our ordinary animal perception, we are getting at the deeper stuff, right? And the fact that we're beginning to kind of get a grip on this, and he's writing in the mid to late 18th century, right, indicates that science, you know, it's like a you know, sign of divine grace kind of thing, right? Where, in a sense, God, you know, the fact that our experiments are working, that we're making more and more sense of this, that I can kind of tell you this history, that we're getting greater and greater knowledge of this kind of phenomena, that people in the ancient times thought was purely hocus-pocus and weird and didn't exist or whatever, now we're getting a greater and greater grip on it, and pretty soon we'll be able to kind of come up with mathematics for it. Okay? That's grace. That's divine grace, providence. That's what's going on. He uses these terms. Okay, now you see, Priestley is the guy who is often credited with having come up with this kind of general view that we talk about in the philosophy of science, a certain kind of scientific realism, you know, realism which being the idea that, you know, the point of science is to come up with the ultimate picture of reality. But what Priestley does is he actually spells it out. Namely, he says, we're actually getting closer and closer with our science. And one of the things that we're beginning to see, right, is our science moves us to understandings of reality that go farther and farther away from our ordinary animal perception. So it goes farther and farther away from the billiard ball kind of stuff that Hume's talking about. And it moves us into these weird realms of fields and so forth. Okay? Now, I'm not saying, you know, Priestley didn't predetermine, he's not like the Nostradamus of the history of science or anything like this. I'm not saying that. But the point is, one of the things that is quite striking, of course, about how the history of science has proceeded from Priestley's time to the present, of course, is that we find the world, you know, is in a way moves us farther and farther from the kinds of modes of understanding that would link us most closely with animals. So we need, as it were, new forms of mathematics. Right, if you think about non-Euclidean geometries, for example, they were originally seen as just imaginative constructs in the 19th century when they were invented. But lo and behold, in the 20th century, they turned out to actually attach to reality. That's interesting. That's interesting, okay? And see, if you see the history of science that way, right, as we get, you know, a greater and greater understanding, we find the world, as it were, to be kind of stranger and stranger, but still comprehensible. Right, it's not stranger and stranger in a way that discourages us from going further. Because that's the important point, right? That's where religion has to be the pro-science argument, right? Because, yes, the world is getting, you know, our understanding of it is getting stranger and stranger. It's moving farther and farther away from the billiard ball causation, but it is not deterring us from going further. That's a very important point. Okay? And then the question becomes, well, why are we motivated on this path? You know, why are we motivated on this path, okay? And I think it's because Newton was basically right. When you're doing science, you're trying to get into the mind of God, you know, and God, the big picture. And you know, in a sense, our normal ways of living, our normal ways of understanding reality, right, only bring to bear a relatively limited portion of what one needs to know to understand the nature of reality. One has to inquire further. One has to go further. Okay? And I think that message really does need to be taught to people as a way of motivating them to do science in a way that goes beyond just whatever the client is willing to pay for. Okay? And I don't see anything very obvious that substitutes the theological motive that I've just been outlining here. Because that's, you know, what I've been describing to you, I think, is historically more or less the theological motive had, the kind of impact it's had. You know, so for example, you know, where does Priestley kind of get so fascinated by electricity and magnetism before he runs into Franklin? He's reading Roger Boscovich, who's this Croatian Jesuit, okay, who's a very obscure figure now in the history of science, but a very important guy who actually kind of invents the idea of fields in the early 18th century. And again, he's thinking about the mind of God and you know, trying to resolve things that Newton wasn't able to resolve. Okay? It's there. It's really clear. Right? And there's a tendency, I think, for a lot of scientists and a lot of popularizers of science to say, oh, these are just historical accidents. Oh, yeah, he happened to be a Jesuit. Oh, he happened to be a Unitarian. Oh, you know, he happened to be this. He happened to be that, you know? You know, Michael Faraday, Sandemanian, you know, whatever. You know, these aren't just accidents, okay? I mean, you know, you can't, like, make everything into an accident. I realize if you're a Darwinist, maybe you can. But the point is, again and again and again, you're finding these people who are being motivated to push forward the frontiers of knowledge, you know, as it were, to sort of postulate these rather counterintuitive hypotheses, which eventually do bear fruit, right, are people who are thinking about getting into the big picture. They're not just trying to save the immediate empirical phenomena. Okay? And I think we really need to be able, you know, if science is going to survive as this big project of trying to come up with a sort of unified, comprehensive understanding of reality, in this 21st century, we need to re-inject that somehow, okay? And see, I see the intelligent design movement as trying to do that, okay? There's been advertisements for my books already, and I hope you buy them and read them. I don't care if you buy them. I'm more concerned you read them than buy them, actually. And if you want them, I can send them to you. There is also this book that's come out in the United States now by Stephen Meyer called The Signature in the Cell. And what's very interesting about this particular book, Harper One, which is a branch of HarperCollins, has just published it. It's come out, I guess, within the past month. I mean, the thing I would like to recommend about that book in terms of how this brings us into the biological discussion is when we think about when biology had its scientific revolution, when it became properly scientific, of course, we normally think of Darwin, Origin of Species, 1859. But what Meyer does, and I think does in a way that's very interesting and very challenging, not only at the scientific level, but also at the philosophical level as well, because he's also a person, he did his PhD at Cambridge in history and philosophy of science. Is he says, actually, the revolution started in 1953, you might say, with the DNA. Okay? When you actually start to get a kind of rational understanding, a language, you know, as where genes literally constitute a kind of language in some sense, and that if you make sense of it in that way, that in terms of a genetic code, you're actually able to get a greater and greater understanding of things. And obviously, this, I mean, he doesn't go into the theological side of this, but come on, the connections with logos are pretty interesting. Okay? I think they're pretty interesting. And I do think it's worth exploring along those lines. So in other words, having the theological motivation for doing science in this big way in the back of your mind would cause you, I think, to reassess the relative importance of certain kinds of events in the history of science and biology. Okay? I mean, because one of the things that if you're a historian of biology that you have to face the facts about is that the kind of people who actually came up with the discovery of DNA in 1953 were really radically different kinds of things. People typically trained in physics, chemistry, and so forth, who had a completely different attitude towards science from the people who were part of the Darwin business. Okay? In other words, those people, in a way, had an attitude towards science much closer to the scientific revolution people, the people who were behind DNA, than somebody like Darwin. And I haven't talked much about Darwin here or where he's coming from, but, you know, Darwin is someone who is very much steeped in the natural theology of his time, you know, the intelligent design theory of his time, through Paley and so forth, but became very much disappointed by it. And I could talk about the concept, because there's actually quite an interesting story about this, because so far I've been trying to present a very positive, uplifting story, but there's also another aspect, I think, of the intelligent design trajectory
which I think Darwin recognized and just turned him off from it. But I won't go into that right this moment. I will take it in questions. But I do think, though, that if we're talking about how to motivate people to do science in this large sense that enabled us to make the major intellectual breakthroughs that have happened since the scientific revolution, we haven't yet found an adequate substitute for the theological motive, which goes back to the idea that we're created in the image and likeness of God. Because that then pushes us, right, to think that we can understand stuff that on the surface might seem very counterintuitive and not very directly related to our day-to-day animal-based existence. So the idea here is that, you know, science becomes a form of self-transcendence alongside of theology. And this was what Priestley was on about, and I think this was the kind of thing that, you know, and what was controversial in the 18th century and continues to be controversial is the extent to which you need institutionalized religion for this. That's the controversial point. But not the belief in God, not the motivation, not that biblical inspiration. That's not really controversial. What's controversial are the institutional forms that it takes. Okay? I'll stop here and open it up to questions.